This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's conflict and then there's high conflict. We'll revisit a conversation from earlier this year about what creates some of our deepest disagreements and how we can talk across the divide with civility and respect. Now, the IRS sent out the first payments of the new monthly child tax credit yesterday, totaling about $15 billion and reaching 35 million families, according to the agency. The payments came months after President Joe Biden signed the policy into law as part of the latest round of COVID-19 relief. He celebrated the start of that program yesterday.
It's one of the largest ever single tax cuts for families with children. And it's a reflection of our belief that the people of this country who need a tax cut aren't the folks at the top. They've got plenty of tax cuts. They're doing just fine. But it's the people in the middle, the folks who are struggling.
We're talking about this change in policy toward what some are calling a guaranteed income for families and what you need to know about getting those payments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. It's just the first few days, but have you seen one of these payments show up in your bank account? If you think you're eligible, what are you planning to do with the money? Do you think this idea of paying families who are raising kids is good public policy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Erwin Garfinkel is a co-director of the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University. He was previously the director of the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. Erwin, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you, and go Bucks.
Definitely. Now, these payments started going out this week. Can you give us the basics? Who is getting what here?
So families that have one child that's 6 to 17 get $300 a month. A child that is 0 to 5 gets $350 a month.
And does that add up per kid then for all kids in those age ranges?
Yes, that's per child, yes.
Now, we've had the earned income tax credit, which, as I understand it, is kind of in the same ballpark as this policy. What is different about the approach under these new tax refunds, rebates, credits, whatever we're calling them?
Well, first of all, the earned income tax credit is just for children who live in poor and a little bit near poor families, lower middle class, middle class. They're not eligible for the earned income tax credit. The child tax credit is nearly universal. Only the very richest families don't get any benefits. And the big change from current policy is that it's threefold. One is that all children before this program under the federal income tax would get a $2,000 per year credit, except the poorest children, poorest third of children, didn't have enough income to offset their tax liability, so they got less than the $2,000, and the poorest tenth got nothing. And so the first thing is it makes the credit refundable so that everyone gets the credit, even if you have no income. Second, it raised the $2,000 to $3,000 for children age 6 to 17, and for $3,600 for children below age 5. And the third difference is the old tax credit you could only get once a year while you filed your income taxes. Now the benefit is being paid monthly. Effectively, it converts the child tax credit into a universal, near universal child allowance.
What do you see as the benefits of doing it this way, of this kind of policy?
Oh, the benefits are enormous. So we estimate that for every dollar spent, society gets $8 in return. And the biggest benefit is from improvements in child health. And those improvements in child health last throughout their lifetime. They will live longer. As a consequence of improved health, they will earn more. They will get more education, and they'll pay more taxes. They'll be less involved in crime. They will need less child protective services. It's an incredibly good investment.
We are talking about the new child tax credit, money just hitting bank accounts this week. Erwin Garfinkel is with us from the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on this program, your questions about it, maybe your experiences if you're seeing this pop up already, if you're a parent who's eligible for these credits. Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Kaukauna. Jeremy, hi.
Hello, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Jeremy?
Well, my wife and I received our first payment. We have two little ones, and I wanted to say I'm very thankful. I've had to, choose to do a side hustle in order to supplement our family's income and be able to keep our head above water. And I appreciate the structure of this tax credit instead of getting a windfall at the end of the year. That it helps with the monthly budgeting.
Jeremy, and what do you have thoughts on what this is going to allow you to do or change, if anything?
I'm spending a little bit more time home. I'm pulling back on some of that extra work that I do outside of my full-time job. But I think that we're going to try and, make memories with the kids, maybe get some karate lessons going for my son, and, find ways to, help stimulate the local economy, but also, plan for the future. I started the EdVest account, so starting to look forward to college for the kids because of this expanded credit, and I hope that they're able to renew it, long term, like Janet Yellen said that she supported.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for that call. Jeremy shared his experience there. He raises a couple of interesting points. First of all, he said that monthly thing makes a difference for him as opposed to that once a year at tax refund time. Even if it's the same amount of money, does that make a difference if it's monthly versus all at once?
Yes, it does. It's definitely what he said. I thought the other two other things he said were very interesting. One, that he would spend the money on children, and that's what the research shows overwhelmingly. The other thing that was interesting is that he will cut back on overtime work, a second job. Most of the conservatives are always talking about this is terrible. People will work less. Well, most of the less work is actually wives, but the second biggest thing are people who are working like him, two jobs, which is crazy for the family, crazy for the child. So he was right on in everything he said. That's remarkable first call.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for that call. And Jeremy raised a point that we haven't gotten to yet, Erwin. This is not scheduled at present, as I understand it, to go on forever. Can you talk about the timeline when this is supposed to expire, at least under the current law?
Yeah, he touched on so many points. Thank you, Jeremy. So, yes, it's only for 1 year. It was passed as part of the Emergency Relief Act, and we're not out of the recession that was caused. Well, we're not out of the great unemployment. Officially, we are out of the recession, but we still 6 million jobs short. So this is it will act to help us get those jobs back. And even for a year, this will for every dollar spent, it'll generate $8. Making it permanent will mean that will happen every single year, that we spend roughly $100 billion and it generates benefits of over $800 billion.
Jeremy, thanks for that call. We're talking to Erwin Garfinkel, co-director of the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University. He's with us today to talk about the new monthly child tax credit, which started sending payments out this week. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support this idea of giving most families, as we heard, everyone except some at the very top of the income spectrum, this guaranteed income, in effect, to help with the cost of raising kids? Do you worry about it leading people to be less motivated to work? Have you gotten this payment yourself? What does it mean to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about the child tax credit now coming to many families in the form of monthly payments that started this week. Erwin Garfinkel is with us from the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University. And you could join in with your thoughts on the child tax credit, your questions about it, your experiences with it. If you're already seeing it show up in your bank account, what are you going to do, if anything, different than you did without that credit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Hartford. Mark, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just kind of have more of a comment or would be interested in hearing opinions on this. I'm married and we have no kids, and we decided not to have kids just due to the kind of climate and everything else going on. But as somebody whose spouse works full time, you know, doesn't make a ton of money an hour, but, you know, is doing the best that they can, it feels kind of, you know, rough when, you know, you think somebody who might have had three, maybe four kids is able to bring home potentially even more than, you know, a full time working adult could, you know, after taxes and everything said and done, you know, just because they chose to have, you know, kids and we didn't. And, you know, obviously I'm all for especially low-income people getting help and assistance that they need. But it feels kind of rough as somebody who could definitely, you know, use the money is still impacted by everything going around.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. So concerns, Erwin, maybe about unfairness to people who don't have kids. What do you think of that concern?
Well, it's a legitimate concern. I'm glad Mark called in and asked the question. But it is the case that the future of the country depends upon children. And raising children is very expensive. And not just for the poor, it's very expensive for lower middle and middle income families as well. And assisting families with children, we're the only rich industrialized nation that doesn't have a universal child allowance. We led in free public education, and that was wise on our part, but we lag in cash assistance, and this is a massive step forward for us as a nation. And it will be an investment that returns benefits to even people like Mark who don't have children.
Mark, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Nicole in Brookfield. Nicole, hello.
Hi. Just to echo the previous caller's sentiments, I do agree. It does kind of, there's a slippery slope because where does it leave people, you know, who don't have kids? But I understand off at age 17. My question is, if this is for the future, how does this really, how does this work? Because 17 and 18-year-olds, you know, they're going to college, they're seniors in high school, most of them, and they tend to be very expensive. You know, college is expensive, high school is expensive.
You're cutting in and out, Nicole. I think I get the gist, the age cutoff here. I think you said kids up to 17 are eligible here, Erwin. Gets a little confusing because I think 17-year-olds weren't eligible for some of the stimulus incentive payments. But Nicole says, why not those 18-year-olds? They may still be dependents, and they can be pretty darn expensive.
True. I can't disagree with that. But Rome wasn't built in a day. This is a step, a huge step in the right direction. I can't disagree with Nicole's point.
Thanks for that call, Nicole. Andrew joins us now, calling from Madison. Andrew, hello.
Hey, yeah, I just wanted to call and say that my wife works full-time. I'm a stay-at-home parent. We can right now afford to send one of our children to daycare, and with the tax credit, we'll be able to send the other to daycare. Mm. And that's going to make it so I'll actually be able to afford to work, because right now, me trying to find a job, we would have to, you know, find a way to pay for daycare as well. So, you know, working is sort of, you know, an uncertainty without the tax credit.
Andrew, thanks for the call. That's an interesting angle, Erwin, the idea that it could free up people like Andrew to pay for childcare and then get back in the job market.
Yeah, I agree. That is interesting. And it's contrary a little bit to economic theory. But I think economic theory is wrong in this case. Andrew being a contrary example, and I don't think he'll be the only one. So I'm glad to hear from him. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks for the call, Andrew. We are talking to Erwin Garfinkel, co-director of the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University, looking at the child tax credits, part of the latest COVID relief package, monthly checks or direct deposits more likely just started this week. They will expire. There's a year worth of them passed by law, at least so far. You could join in with your thoughts, questions, and let us know if you're seeing those payments and what you're doing with them, if you're willing to share that, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Erwin, I think a question some people might have is, this isn't means tested. If the goal here was something like poverty relief, why not focus this on lower income people? Why does it go up all the way through middle and even into upper middle class?
It's not just the poor who will benefit, and the children of lower middle income children. It'll be a less proportionate increase in their income for middle-income children. Even lower middle-income children, proportionately, it will be less. But the evidence is very clear that the children will benefit up to pretty much through the upper income. The bottom four-fifths of children are likely to be better off because their parents will get more income. The increase will be less for the upper middle, the top fourth of the distribution, but it will be positive still. It doesn't go to zero, the benefits of these child allowances, till very high in the income distribution. I don't have time to go into the study, and there's not a lot of research on this particular question, but there's one wonderful piece of research from Norway that shows exactly what I'm saying. It comes from the oil boom in Norway. So we're not all Norwegians. That's the problem. We can't. And Norway is different institutionally. But actually, Wisconsin's got a fair number of Norwegians.
Let's go back to our callers now. Adam is with us in Sparta. Adam, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, my stepson, my wife, and his father share taxes every other year. And right now, his father is going to get the refund, even though he lives with us full time. I'm curious how that can affect us at the end of the year.
Adam, thanks for the call. Now, this is going to be a common situation, a lot of mixed custody arrangements, step-parent arrangements like that. Erwin, do you know how that's going to be untangled with these checks or direct deposits?
I wish I did. It's a very important, interesting question. You're pushing me beyond my knowledge. I don't know how that will be. I'm ignorant. Sorry.
Me too, unfortunately. Adam, good luck in untangling that. Time for one more caller. Rebecca is with us in Fort Atkinson. Rebecca, hi.
Hi there. I was just calling. I got my tax credit this week. I have two little girls. And one of the things that I just kept thinking was that this money kind of buys time and some mental relief in thinking about sort of enrichment things that I can do with my kiddos that I wasn't able to do prior to this, and just a little bit more space. The cost of childcare is astronomical while teachers don't earn very much, and it just takes a huge chunk out of sort of space to think about other things to do with the kids and frees up a little bit of time and money and energy.
Rebecca, thanks a lot for sharing your story. Appreciate it. Erwin, in just our last minute, what are you watching for now as we figure out the impact, not just on Rebecca, but nationwide of these payments?
We're watching to see how much poverty is reduced. We're estimating almost by half. We're also seeing what parents will spend their money on. And Rebecca's story, and I'm forgetting now the other person who talked about childcare, the name, but that is very common. And we have evidence from not the U.S., but from the United Kingdom, when they did a similar policy, that parents spent the money on children.
Erwin, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Erwin Garfinkel, co-director of the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University. He was with us today to talk about the start of the new monthly child tax credit. The IRS started sending out payments for that program yesterday. People up for direct deposit of tax refunds should have started seeing those payments in their bank accounts as early as yesterday. Others may see checks in the mail instead. Coming up, we take a listen back to our conversation with journalist Amanda Ripley about why some disagreements turn into hateful conflicts and how we can start to find a way out of them. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We all run into conflict in our lives, and sometimes that can be a good thing. It pushes us to consider other viewpoints or be better people. But some disagreements run deeper when two people or two groups start seeing each other as the enemy. Talking across that divide can feel impossible. Our next guest has spent years studying high conflict, from bitter divorce proceedings to brutal decades-long civil wars, and says if we understand how it works, we'll have a better chance to turn down the temperature and have meaningful discussions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found yourself in a disagreement with someone in your life that seemed like it had no way out? Did you find a way out? Have you found a productive way to talk with those you disagree with, personally or politically? Are there issues that you think people could find more common ground on if they talked with each other, but in the right way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Amanda Ripley is a journalist and author. Her latest book out now is called High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Can Get Out. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
When, Amanda, does a normal conflict, which can actually be good and healthy, turn into this high conflict?
Right. So conflict itself is not the enemy. It's when conflict distills into a kind of us versus them feud and eventually takes on a life of its own. And our brain behaves differently. We start making mistakes. We miss opportunities. And everything we do to try to end the conflict usually makes it worse. That's a sign that you're in high conflict.
You talk to a lot of people who have been in conflict or dealt with it in different ways. You learned some lessons in a couple different ways from a Gary Friedman, a lawyer who started working with divorce in a different way. And this is a really personal example of how high conflict can spiral out of control between two people. How did he tackle divorce differently?
You know, Gary was a traditional family law attorney, and he just found himself getting really dispirited with the way most legal proceedings leave everyone feeling a little worse, even the so-called winner. So he ended up, two friends of his who were getting divorced, a couple, they came to him and they said, this was years ago, and they said, could you help us through this divorce? And he said, well, you know, I'd actually have to represent just one of you, and then someone else would have to represent the other. And he just started, you know, kind of parroting all the usual legalese. And they were upset and they said, why can't there be a way we can all work this out in a room together? And so he took a risk. He'd never done it before. At the time, it was pretty unheard of. And that's what he did. And they worked together for 4 months in this room, and it wasn't easy, but it wasn't two lawyers hashing it out while everybody else sat on the sidelines. It was the people who really owned the problem and understood what the solutions should be. And that became something we now call conflict mediation, which is a huge practice that is really outside the normal kind of us versus them arena of the legal system, the traditional legal system.
And there are a lot of lessons in this that apply to the other kinds of conflict you talk about. But starting with that core idea that, okay, going into this, you are adversaries. This is an adversarial relationship. And whether we're talking about divorce or politics or whatever, once you're on team A and I'm on team B, certain things start to happen. What happens then, Amanda?
You know, there's something about humans that once you sort us into two groups, it just brings out our worst conflict instincts. There's been a ton of research on this, but one example that I think is kind of fun to think about is conflict in outer space. So this is something NASA has looked at quite a bit because they want to do these deep space missions to Mars. So they really can't have dysfunctional conflict on a Mars mission, right? You need each other. You're in a confined space. It's stressful. So they've done these simulations of deep space missions, which are totally fascinating. And the longest simulation of a deep space mission to date, which was conducted in Moscow a few years ago, six men from four countries spent 17 months living in a small concrete building, pretending to go to Mars without sunrises or sunsets, with no real-time contact with friends or family. And each week they answered a survey about interpersonal conflicts. And there were 49 conflicts that they bothered to report. Presumably there were many more that didn't make the survey. And so one lesson NASA has learned is that you cannot pick a no-conflict crew. Crew members get distressed by bad news from home and take it out on one another. They have trouble sleeping, get on each other's nerves. You know, just like on Earth, there's unlimited sources of conflict in outer space. But here's the thing. There's one particular kind of conflict that's virtually guaranteed to happen, which is conflict between the crew and ground control down on Earth, right? So that's the power of the binary. Anytime you break humans into two groups, Democrats and Republicans, white, black, good, evil, crew, ground control, it tends to bring out instincts that make conflict less healthy. Not always, but usually. There's this one group here in space, my group, and that other one down on Earth, the other. So a lot of the astronauts' frustration gets redirected onto ground control. And in that particular Mars simulation, the crew reported five times as many conflicts with ground control as with each other.
We're talking to Amanda Ripley about her new book, High Conflict, Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. Amanda, as you describe high conflict, it sounds overwhelming and scary, but a big point of your work is that even in the worst situations, it is possible to come out of it. And I want to look at maybe the most extreme situation you present in the book, Sandra in Colombia, who's involved in this generations-long brutal guerrilla war in her country as a combatant. Can you share a little of her story and how she came out of this, what looked to me like a unsolvable conflict situation?
Right. Yeah. So I went to Colombia because I wanted to see what this country, I mean, this is a country for better and for worse that knows a ton about conflict, right? And they have spent many decades trying to get people to leave political, violent conflict. And many things they've tried have not worked, but some things have. And so for this project, I ended up spending time with Sandra, whom you mentioned, who, like a lot of people who entered Colombia's civil war, started out doing it as a young girl. So she was about 12 years old. She witnessed a neighbor of hers who was an elder who was respected get assassinated right in front of her eyes by gunmen who just pulled up and shot her. And it was very upsetting. And she'd been, you know, with her family on the run for many years because of the violence in Colombia. So she decided then and there to leave her family and join the FARC, which is the large guerrilla group in Colombia. And she spent years engaged in this high conflict. And then eventually, as have many thousands of other FARC members, left the conflict willingly, entering a demobilization and reintegration program run by the Colombian government. So it was not an easy process by any means, but was really interesting for me was to see the patterns in her experience and how they connected with the other people I followed. You know, I followed a politician in California, a former gang leader in Chicago, an environmental activist in England. And in every case, including Sandra in Colombia, all these people were at some point trapped in high conflict, and they're not anymore. But they didn't stop fighting. They didn't suddenly change their mind. Sandra still fights for justice for the Colombian people, but they're much more effective in how they do it. So that was the interesting distinction for me that, you know, I came into this trying to figure out, looking for hope, you know, to understand how do people get out of really ugly conflicts, personal, political, all kinds of conflict. And what I found out was it's not about getting out of conflict. It's really about getting out of high conflict. And how does that happen? And how can you nudge people out of high conflict at scale?
And what is a first step toward that nudge?
One thing that's very important is to recognize saturation points. This is a point at which the conflict begins to feel too heavy to bear. And it's sort of like hitting bottom for an alcoholic, right? It's any kind of shock that happens to the conflict system. In gang violence, it could be as simple as a snowstorm. So there's a period of peace for 24 hours. Or it could be somebody dies or somebody gets shot. Or in an ugly divorce, it could be a child gets sick. It's something that destabilizes the conflict temporarily. Now, this is where other people are really important. The people around you who are not in thrall to high conflict help you realize all that you've lost. So waiting for those moments, seizing those saturation points, it's very, very important. Like timing matters a lot. And then once you do that, one of the things that's common to all those stories that I mentioned is that nobody I know who has left high conflict did it without distancing themselves from the conflict entrepreneurs in their lives.
Conflict entrepreneurs. Tell us who they are.
Those are the people, or sometimes companies, or sometimes media outlets or platforms that exploit conflict for profit in some cases, or attention or power. Often it's for meaning, a sense of purpose. But these are the people, sometimes they're in our, you know, regular life, the people who seem to sort of delight in every twist and turn the conflict takes, right? And I'm sure I've been a conflict entrepreneur at some point. As a journalist, it's very easy to do that. So realizing what's happening, who is benefiting from the conflict, because it's usually only the conflict entrepreneurs, and distancing yourself from those people or platforms or channels if you want to get out of high conflict. In the case of Curtis Toler, a former high-ranking gang leader I followed in Chicago, he literally moved across town. So he physically distanced himself. And then two things happened. First, people couldn't find him easily at first. And secondly, when his cousin was brutally murdered, he didn't know who did it, right? So it slowed down the conflict, which is key to getting out of high conflict. So he wasn't as interested in taking revenge and continuing that cycle because he had a little bit of distance.
We're talking to Amanda Ripley, author of the book High Conflict, Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found a way to bridge a formerly unbridgeable gap, personal or political, with people in your family, workplace, community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Coming up, field trips from New York to Michigan, conservatives and liberals getting together. What happens? We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Amanda Ripley, author of the new book, High Conflict, Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. Amanda, I want to spend some time on the last chapter of your book, a really powerful story. A liberal synagogue congregation in New York, a conservative group of correctional officers in Michigan, and they end up doing mutual field trips and staying with each other. Can you tell us about that story? We could take some time on this one because it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's a really wild story, and it starts on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where there's a mega synagogue called B'nai Jeshurun. And it, over the century, has become one of the most influential Jewish communities in the United States. And a few years ago, this synagogue nearly came undone, torn apart by internal political controversy over Israel. And this is something that has happened in other synagogues. In this case, because of its influence and location, this controversy landed on the front page of the New York Times. It was very embarrassing for everyone involved. People started withholding their donations. Others threatened to leave the synagogue altogether. The rabbis were more left-leaning on Israel, and many of the congregants were more right-leaning, very protective of Israel. And this was a shock to the rabbis. The reaction was so sudden and volcanic. So they did what most of us do when we encounter sudden conflict within our own group, which is they really tried to make it go away and hope it never came back, right? Which generally, you know, unfortunately doesn't work, right? But they tried to apologize and move on. And then, of course, it flared up again a few months later over something else. Usually that kind of conflict, if you don't deal with it in a healthy way, just kind of ferments underground. So they ended up finally, after years of this kind of agony, deciding that they were going to do conflict differently. They were just going to literally spend a year going into conflict in a careful way instead of trying to avoid it. And they brought in some mediators who had worked on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and they had like hard conversations, and they tried to understand each other even as they totally disagreed. And it was really a massive investment in cultural change within this one institution, which most institutions don't want to do. Like they'll have a workshop, but they won't invest, you know, that amount of time in it. Anyway, they ended up getting to a place where they could, as the rabbi put it for me, tolerate the discomfort of someone else's opinion. So even as they disagreed, they felt like they understood each other better, which is like the key to the kingdom. Then when they came into another conflict, as inevitably happens in this case over whether the rabbis should perform interfaith marriages, they were able to do the same thing, to lean into the conflict, to have hard conversations, to really get into it and try to understand what's underneath it. Like, what is this conflict really about? Most conflicts are not about the things we talk about. They're about identity, fear, that kind of thing. And then this gets to your question. Finally, they, after Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, most of the people in the synagogue didn't know anyone who had voted for Trump. They were very distressed. So they didn't know how to lean into conflict because they didn't know anyone with whom they were in conflict with over this. So eventually they end up doing this exchange program with a group of Christian conservatives who live in rural Michigan and work at their local prisons as corrections officers, where literally the New Yorkers, the liberal New York Jews, come to Michigan and stay in the homes of the conservatives for 3 days. They have all kinds, they lean into the conflict again. They do things together. They go to a firing range. They eat Superman ice cream, which the New Yorkers had never had. And they have really difficult conversations. And this magical thing happens where they become curious about each other, which they weren't before they met each other. And then the Michigan conservatives came to New York City for 3 days, stayed in the apartments of the New Yorkers, went to the synagogue for services, visited Trump Tower, all kinds of things. And it wasn't like this kumbaya was there with them. It was very interesting to watch. It wasn't like a kumbaya, you know, moment of fantasy. It was much more interesting than that. You know, it was really interesting to see the things that surprised each other. It was sort of amazing how little they understood each other beforehand and how much affection they came to have for each other, even as they continued to like wildly disagree on many things.
And that's a key. They didn't try to persuade each other. They didn't, it doesn't sound like anybody really changed their politics at all, but they changed their understanding of each other's motivations.
Yeah, it's hard to explain because I think we've sort of lost that awareness that there is a third way. Like you can keep screaming at each other, right? Trying to persuade each other, which doesn't work. You can surrender or give in, right? Or which doesn't feel right, isn't right often. But there's another way, which is trying to understand each other, even as you disagree. And what you find out is you get much more clear and accurate about where the disagreements actually are. And you're able to hold a lot more complexity in your head. So one of the women, Martha Acklesberg, who went from New York to Michigan, she told me, you know, that there was something about this trip that made her feel like the person she most wanted to be. You know, she was open. She was curious. She was also honest about expressing her own beliefs. She ended up hosting a Michigan conservative named Caleb Follett, who literally could not be more different from her in many ways. You know, he has an arsenal of guns in his home, and he listens to, you know, he watches Fox News. And Martha is a liberal academic who started the Women's Studies Department at Smith College. Their differences in age and class and politics and religion, but they came to really have this incredible, obvious affection for each other. And she said to me, you know, I wish I could appear everywhere in my life the way I felt called to appear on this trip, present, open, able to be surprised. And I think that's the mark of good conflict, right? When you can disagree and still feel like the kind of person you want to be.
Let's bring on a caller. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hi.
Hi. Wow, your guest almost said everything I was going to say. And that is that understanding means now I can do something I wasn't able to do before. Understanding begins with listening. I read a book called Getting More. He said, let's grow up, please. You can't have everything, but you can have more. I heard of a couple who said that the reason that they lived so long together was that they never hated each other at the same time. There was always somebody there to look out for the homestead.
Bill, thanks for that call. And Bill started with the listening there, Amanda, which is a key lessons for listening for us and maybe for us in the media while you're at it.
Yeah, you know, I did about 80 hours of conflict mediation training for this book, and I went into it a little bit overconfident. I thought I knew how to interview people because I'd done it for 20 years as a journalist, but it turned out that, you know, there's a difference between looking like you're listening, you know, nodding and smiling and furrowing your brow and laughing at the right moments. There's a difference between that and proving to someone that you are really trying to understand them, you know, which usually takes the form of listening and then playing back for them in the most elegant language you can muster, the most important thing to them that you heard, and then checking to see if you got it right. It may sound sort of squishy, but there's actually a ton of really interesting research on this that shows that when you do this, when you prove, you demonstrate through actions that you have listened, even if you get it wrong, which you often do, right? And people say, no, that's not exactly right. People open up. The next thing they say tends to be less extreme and more interesting. People almost never feel heard, but it is often the thing they want most.
Amanda, in our last few moments, I mean, had I done the work that you'd done, I'm not sure if I would feel frightened for the future or hopeful for the future. Mm-hmm. Looking at the conflicts you've looked at, where do you end up falling?
Rob, that is like, it changes day by day. On the one hand, I feel much more hopeful because I have seen it. Like, I was skeptical of this idea that people could have good conflict. And I have now seen it in front of my face enough times that I know it's a real thing. I've seen people make that journey from high conflict to good conflict. So I know it can be done. I also know that we have set up a lot of our institutions, from politics to many journalistic outlets to social media, to incite high conflict. So we incentivize conflict entrepreneurs. Now, the good thing is we can change that. Like, we built those things and we can redesign them. But, you know, it starts with understanding high conflict and getting more sophisticated so we can fight smart, you know, because the truth is, whether we like it or not, as Americans, we are married to each other, right? Like, we can get divorced, but we have kids together. So we have to find a way to fight that leaves us with some sense of dignity.
Amanda, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Amanda Ripley, journalist and author. She was with us to talk about her newest book. It's called High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out.